Hello and welcome in.
First Science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Well, good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. And this week, we are exploring a science art weekender. Now, my guest is Dr. Sharma Raman, who seems to have an incredible number of strings to her bow. Not only is she a bona fide scientist with a PhD in musical creativity, she's also a successful actress, international musician, and founder of the award-winning science art production company, Jugular, joining the head and the heart, which explores cutting-edge science through creative performance, bringing together science, art, philosophy, and entertainment. Good morning, Sharma.
I'm in awe
of how much you've done. That's incredible. I also love the name, but for anyone that doesn't quite get the reference, could you explain it?
Yeah, so I guess the jugular is the jugular vein, and the tagline is joining the head and the heart. And in this case, we're talking about the head in terms of theoretical academic subjects, and the heart being a more sort of visceral, performative or lived experience sort of a thing. So that's kind of why it's science married with arts.
Brilliant. And this week you actually are doing your weekender. Now,
yes.
What is that?
So it's a showcase of all the artistic work that we currently have in the pipeline. There are two shows. One is a science cabaret. So as its name implies, it's short performances. And the interesting thing is there's also short talks as well. And we're bringing together a very diverse group of scientists and performers to talk about the topic of the heart and all the different ways we can talk about the heart. Which is a really interesting thing because obviously everybody links to the heart from a cultural point of view, from an emotional point of view, and we've divided the whole thing into three sections: the physical heart, the social heart, and the emotional heart. And then the other show that we're doing is a very special rehearsed reading of a full-length play that was developed in relationship with the National Prion Clinic. It's called An Inevitable.
So just to say, what is a prion?
A prion is a very interesting thing. It's a transmittable brain protein that misfolds and makes the other proteins around it misfold as well. And it creates plaques in your brain. And very recent research has shown that it could have the same underlying genetic mechanisms as Alzheimer's and dementia. So although prion disease sounds quite rare, this play actually highlights the commonalities that it can, you know, affect at least one person that we know in our lives. And the play is called An Inevitable Stitch in Time.
Another great title.
It's quite interesting, yeah. So, it's about insomnia and time and prions, basically, yeah.
Brilliant. We're going to hear a lot more about them throughout the show, as well as your own background in creativity. But it's a science mixtape first, because we do not just have Sharma with us in the studio. We actually have some of the other scientists and artists that have been collaborating with her on this weekend. The studio has never been so full. So we're just going to go around. I'm going to ask you all to introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners, please.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for having us here this morning. I'm especially enjoying sitting on this science school lab stool that I haven't sat on since I think I was about 15. My name is Catherine Templer Lewis, and I work as a science creative, science communicator and journalist. I write for Vice, The Huffington Post, basically science storytelling. I have a background in performance as well as genetics and psychology, and I just go and find the stories about why we're human and spread them.
Amazing.
My name is Cassandra. I'm a neuroscientist and working in psychiatry in the medical school at University of Sussex. So our research in our group is about relating what's going on in your body, the physical state of your body, with your emotional and cognitive processing. So we work on demonstrating how things like your heartbeat actually influence your mind and your thoughts.
Wow. And you're involved with the kind of emotional aspect of the heart in this show.
Yeah. I jump up as a scientist and show some slides and present some data and ask all sorts. I get some great questions afterwards, and it's such a nice thing to be able to do this kind of public engagement work where we can actually speak to people and translate what we're doing in a kind of theoretical lab way into real life experiences.
Brilliant. And the fourth member of the studio.
Hello, I'm Kishan Manani, and I'm a PhD student at Imperial College London who works on the mathematical modelling of abnormal heart rhythms.
Great. And so you're also more involved in the kind of physical aspects of the heart in this show.
Exactly, yes.
Perfect. Now, we do have a weekly experiment, and it is heart-related. We're going to be trying a heart-syncing experiment that is in this cabaret. So if you want to get involved at home, all you need is a way to measure your heartbeat. Now, I know there's loads of fitness watches around, Fitbits, but if you don't have one, then here at Science Mixtape, we are just using our smartphones and a really clever app called Instant Heart Rate. It's free to download. You have to pay for the more advanced functions, but it measures your pulse just by, if you put your finger over your camera, it uses the flash function to look at the blood flow through your fingertip, and that's how it measures your pulse. So, yep, get that downloaded, and we'll be coming to that in section two of the show. Now, as always, we want to hear from you. You can tweet us throughout at Soho Radio with the hashtag Science Mixtape. But if you want something to tweet about, we've got our weekly brain teaser. So this is courtesy of my guest today. What do these four things have in common? Slime, the tongue, bees, and the heart. If you think you know, send us a tweet and we will be revealing the answer at the end of the show. So once more, what do those four things have in common? Slime, the tongue, bees, and the heart. Now, the music today, you have linked to the heart, songs from your cabaret, I believe.
That's right.
Could you introduce the first song, Heart of Glass by Blondie?
Aha, this was chosen by Kaz, so...
yeah, I think I was just going on, there's so many songs about the heart, and Blondie's pretty awesome, right? So, Heart of Glass, a legendary song, emotional tagline with a breaking heart, the delicacy of the heart, and then we can just rock out the Blondie as well.
Love it.
Exercise may increase your creative potential. American scientists noted that 2 hours after engaging in rigorous physical activity, test subjects proved more mentally fertile and scored higher on creative thinking tests.
And that was the first of our creative facts from producer Yaz there, linking into your creative background.
I was wondering, yeah.
And the whole creativity of this project, it's incredible. So tell me a bit more about the history of Jugular. Mm. You started it in 2011. And
started as a concept in 2011 because we got commissioned by Secret Garden Party in Wilderness to...
that is very cool.
Yeah, it was cool. It was to do 2 shows, actually. We ended up doing 6 hours of material for this festival. So it was like we had the theme of the past and the future. So it was kind of loosely related around physics and quantum theory and complexity and space travel, essentially, was the future sort of section of it. And then the past-facing thing was more about consciousness. And these 2 shows basically ended up getting re-put on in London. So the future-facing one became an immersive warehouse rave about physics, according to the Londonist.
Wow.
Which is really interesting.
Tell me more about that.
That was cool. It was like a site-specific thing. It was also in a warehouse, but I suppose less polished than our wonderful ugly duck. That's the venue we're at this weekend. And we created like a sort of a jugular lab, which was going to be a lovely mixture of the artistic and the scientific process behind investigating something. So I guess the whole thing came about because you asked me about, you know, how Jugular kind of came about, and it's because I'm both a performer and a scientist, and I often used to get the question, but they're wildly differing things, how do you actually do that? So I guess I got tired of answering that question because I naturally saw it, and as Catherine was saying, I would call it storytelling. So, you know, and I've also had a lot of experience curating events. Started off as I was telling you earlier, actually, was that I was the head of marketing at a radio station at UCL. It was called Rare FM at the time. So from that...
Shout out to one of our other DJs, Virgil Howe.
Hello.
Used to promote him, apparently.
I did used to promote him, yeah. So, you know, we used to put on these wonderful evenings mixing well-known musicians with our wonderful student musicians. And from that, you know, I ended up curating a lot of, you know, we did festivals at the South Bank, theatre stuff, etc. So
one day a friend of mine was just like, why don't you put this all together in your practice and create an art science thing? This is what you are. So yeah, that's where it came
it's
from.
It's really exciting. Yeah. And award winning.
Yeah, we got the public engagement award from the Institute of Physics for this particular warehouse rave we're telling you about.
Amazing.
So yeah, it was a mixture of promenade, lots of talks, physical theatre, games, all sorts of things. So, yeah.
I really like the idea of sort of a lot of people do believe that, like at school, I think you're just taught like either sciencey or you're arty.
That's right.
I think
yeah.
it's so important to actually bring the two together because you have to be quite creative to be good at research. You've got to, you know,
absolutely.
Come up with new ideas and look at things in new ways that have never been looked at before.
Yeah, in fact, it's called problem solving, right? That's actually a type of creativity. So, you know, that was done, it's a PhD hat coming on, but... Yeah, there was a guy called Wallace who did a lot of case studies across different disciplines, which included architecture, design, music, all sorts of things, mathematicians, scientists, engineers, and came across four different sort of broad stages of creativity that they all shared. So
I'm going to stop you there because we're going to come back to that later.
Yeah.
But I want to bring Catherine in now because why have you chosen to focus on the heart for this particular weekend?
Hello. Well, the heart. First of all, we will have one, I think.
Yes.
So it's relevant to everybody.
It's relevant to everybody. Yes. And, you know, you take the heart out of the body and it is this physical organ. In fact, actually, the cells they're wonderful. They're myocardial, which means that if you take the cells of the heart out of the body and give them oxygen, they will continue beating regardless of where they are. You have a pacemaker to coordinate it. So then you put it back in the body and suddenly it becomes more than that. We have the emotional heart. We have the social heart. We have the physical heart. You know, ask anybody about the heart and they instantly think of sort of heartbreak.
Yep.
And I think it's a very sort of topical.
Home is where the heart is. There's so many
anymore.
Sort of
heartfelt. Yeah. We were doing this yesterday.
Yeah. Wear your heart on your sleeve.
Wear your heart on your sleeve. That's a very good one.
You know.
Yeah, come to the cabaret. I understand what we're talking about. Yeah.
I think it's just a topic that, you know, and the heart is, as these wonderful scientists will tell you, it's more than a muscle. It's linked to the brain. You know, it's one of the organs which helps us to become more than the sum of our parts. And I think it's something very beautiful in that. You know, there's a lot of sentiment. You know, every story, you know, is based around love at the end of the day. And there's a lot of interesting things going on with the heart. There's a lot of work looking at what love is. You know, we were talking earlier about love can be defined in three stages: lust, attraction, and attachment. In the attachment stage, you're producing a lot of the chemical or the hormone oxytocin, which makes you feel attached to someone.
Yeah, and that's in all stages of love. You get oxytocin between mum and baby.
That's right. Yeah,
you get
and
it.
Apparently in weddings as well.
Yeah.
Even if you're not the one getting married.
Yeah. And there are now drugs you can take that block oxytocin uptake. So technically, if you were heartbroken over someone,
you could take
a drug that would stop this feeling of attachment. You know, but would you want to do that?
I mean, that is a really good question. Listeners, if you have an opinion on this, please tweet in at Soho Radio. Would you take a drug to get over heartbreak? Or like you said before, when you start falling in love with someone and you're really attracted to them, you get a drop in your serotonin, that's a neurotransmitter in your brain.
You get a drop in it. Yeah. It mimics sort of addiction and obsessive compulsive disorder, and you can take drugs that boost serotonin to help tackle these problems. But you know, if you were lovesick over someone, would you want to take this drug to stop you feeling this sort of lust and crave?
It is quite compulsive. You're thinking about them all the time. You can't you get sort of
it does feel like an addiction.
Yeah. Worried about them when they're not there. What are they thinking of you? You become obsessed.
Yeah, you can't do any work. It's a disaster.
Oh my god, why do we even fall in love?
So
I mean, it sounds like a disease.
A cure for unrequited love as well.
I mean, well, one of the major inspirations for creating this cabaret was actually Kaz's was Kaz's interoceptive work, in the sense that as a performer, we always talk about the heart being linked to the mind, as Catherine was saying, and I guess we do say things like heartbroken. We do feel things in our heart area rather than in our brain. And so, you know, Kaz's incredible work was like a hard knock science sort of background behind how this can actually be possible. So, you know, she'll tell you more about it.
yes indeed. And for people listening, your event's on this weekend, so where and when?
So the Rhythms of the Heart cabaret is tonight at 7:30, and we have an associated workshop at 5 o'clock where we go through all of the different scientific principles, but we teach them in through theatre techniques. You don't have to be an actor, don't get scared. It's all about about embodied learning. We actually get you up on your feet in order to try and learn this. So it's a genuine sort of example of joining the head and the heart. It's going to be at the Ugly Duck venue in Bermondsey. It's on Tanner Street, 47 to 49 Tanner Street near London Bridge. It's a beautiful warehouse. It's where Dragon's Den was filmed.
Wow.
Also, the whole thing starts off at 2 o'clock. We're previewing the play and Inevitable Stitch in Time, which you can also see tomorrow at 2 o'clock. So.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Let's move on to song number two. Who would like to introduce this one? It's Cold, Cold Heart by Dinah Washington.
I think that was our musical guy, Elliot, who picked that one, and he just said that it's a classic, beautiful song, and another one with heart in the title. Another one of the millions of songs about the heart. So again, showing how much we all just care about the bloody heart.
Another love before my time made your heart sad and blue, and so my heart is paying now for things I did not do. In anger, unkind words are said that makes the teardrop start. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
Surgeon Charles Lim used MRI scanners and improvised jazz to show increased activity in an area of the brain responsible for language development, implying the body's most essential organs may recognise music as akin to speech.
Very apt for this next section, Rhythms of the Heart. So what was the idea? This is actually an experiment you're incorporating in the cabaret. What was the idea behind it?
So there's two bits of research, one of which has become very popular and has coined the phrase, those who sing together sync together. Don't know if you can guess what that means, but...
No.
Essentially, they found that choirs who sang together ended up synchronizing their heartbeats, which is interesting and amazing in and of itself.
Yeah.
And then there's another piece of research which shows that the synchrony of hearts is the basis for group empathy. So we wanted to link these two pieces of research together in a social experiment, and that's what we do, and it worked really well last night. So we're going to talk about it to you now, rather than giving it away. We're going to try and get you to do it.
I am now opening up my heart rate measuring app, and what you, or if you've got your watch or whatever at home, and we are all here in the studio going to place our fingers on the camera, and it takes about 10 seconds and it will tell us our different heart rates and heartbeats. I'm going to see who's really nervous about being on air.
Okay, let's check.
Mine's zero.
Oh, Sharma, that is a little worrying. Mine's quite high. Mine is 93.
Mine is now saying 47.
Mine's saying 51. I'm obviously
very healthy.
Still fast asleep.
That's what I was thinking.
I'm looking at the
or
data
very
Sharma's
healthy,
tracking
yes.
here. I'm kind of cautious that's not a true representation of our heart rate.
That
there.
Doesn't sound
That's
right.
a measurement error. Sharma's not
39.
Got a pulse of 49.
I mean, interestingly, your heart rate, it's lots of different factors can you know, be associated with it. People with low heart rates, it can be genetic, it can be that you're incredibly athletic, which I'd like to pretend because you can't all see
it,
me.
Not me.
That's why mine is low. And you know, things can, you know, we have an amazing response system within our body to things like adrenaline, stress. We can instantly ramp up that heart rate when we need to, just to get blood around the body. It is
Absolutely.
A pump at the end of the day.
It's one of those things that actually you wish you could control more sometimes. I mean, when you're nervous and your heart's pounding, it's not always that helpful.
Yeah.
No, that's kind of the sort of the work that I do is about interoception, which is your relationship to the feelings that are going on in your body. So this feeling of having your heart pumping in your chest, that's some people are very aware of that all the time, and that might have implications for why people develop anxiety. So if you're in a situation where your heart is beating really fast and you're feeling it really strong, that kind of normally signals to your body that you're in a scared emotional state and maybe you need to run away and fight, this kind of fight or flight reflex. Mm. But if you're the kind of person who's always aware of their heart all the time, you could be doing something completely innocuous, like sitting on a bus or traveling on a train, doing nothing that's really that scary. Then all of a sudden you have this sensation of your heart beating really strongly. So even though you're doing nothing, your body is saying there's a strong heartbeat going on here, so there must be something scary in my environment. So you associate those two feelings, that strong sensation of your heartbeat, which you just happen to have as a person who has a strong sensation of their heartbeat, and that situation of being on a bus. And that might lead you to develop a kind of social anxiety. So some of the work that we're talking about in the workshop, in my talk, is sort of suggesting that we all have a different relationship with our body signals. Some feel them really strongly, some feel them not so much. And these differences in relationship can affect our sort of psychiatric well-being and our mental health.
Yeah, and I think that's something that can change, isn't it? I actually have a friend who has suffered from anxiety and panic attacks and now says that they can feel their heart rate all the time.
Yeah.
Like lying, apparently sometimes when they read, they can see the book kind of beating because their whole body is moving with this heart rate.
And that's quite a worrying situation for them, because they're like, when I feel my heart like this, it's because I'm going to have a panic attack. And you end up in this kind of loop where you're going, my heart's beating fast, so I'm scared. Now I'm scared because my heart's beating fast. And you're stuck in this loop inside yourself. And this is why it can spiral out of control and become things like a panic attack.
Yeah, I think that two-way process is so interesting, because I think so much of the time we believe that we are processing the world and that making decisions and deciding how we feel. But actually, you're right, so much is that we sense something and then our brain tries to find reasons why we feel that way.
Exactly. Yeah, so that goes back to some really classical like interpretations of psychology, James Lang theory, that our emotions are our body's way of telling us what's going on in the world. So we don't have an emotion and then our body reacts to it. Our body reacts before we even know what's happening.
Before we process it.
Exactly, before we process it. And then it tries to tell us what's happening by making us have a different emotion or changing our heart rate, something
like
that.
It's like what you were saying, the emotion can start in
So it's like what you were saying yesterday, that emotion can start in the body rather than in the mind.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Right, so I think hopefully everyone at home has measured their heart rate as well. So now, in order for us to sync, we need to sing.
Yes.
What song are we going to be singing to?
Rhythm is a dancer.
Another classic here. We've got a wonderful, wonderful musician working with us, Elliot Lloyd Short. And what he's actually doing as part of the cabaret is taking people's heartbeats and then creating tracks live with those heartbeats. And this is one for him. So if everyone at home could sing along.
Turn the volume up.
Maybe have a little dance as well. That's probably not going to hurt.
Not at all. It worked really well yesterday.
Which
we'll be doing here. So
Walk down memory lane for some people.
We'll be partying in the studio. We're not going to make you listen to us singing along with the whole song. We will play the song and I'll fade it in and out.
It's not a cappella version. Who's got the words?
Here we go.
Stress harms creativity, just like it harms mental health, the heart, and many other things. Stress negatively impacts creative expression, particularly when it involves rigid timeframes and criteria.
Many thanks to the helicopter outside for providing the bed to that fact. anyone not in London, it is the Queen's birthday, and there's a lot of celebration going on outside. So, quickly, time to re-measure our heart rate and see if we have synced. Here we go.
Ooh, it's the excitement. I hope someone gets an anomalous result. That's always my favourite.
Oh, this is good. I've come down a lot. So before we started, I was at about 120, which is mostly because I'm really unhealthy and I've had a lot of coffee. But through that process, I've dropped down to about 103.
Great.
I went from 40 to 66.
So you've come up.
Ooh. I've gone up from 51 to 67.
Oh my God, we're quite synced.
Yeah, quite
synced. We're approaching statistical significance.
Oh my God.
About
the one man.
I've got from 80 down to 77.
Ooh, oh. And I've gone from 93 to 78.
Ooh. We're trending. This is a very very clear linear trend here as we all approach some undefined set level. So once we get the data from everyone else, I'm sure we'll be able to plot a beautiful graph and we've definitely
They're going to tweet in, right?
Yeah, please tweet us in your heart rates too. I hope you enjoyed singing along as much as we did. So in terms of the physical, social and emotional parts of the heart, that's a really interesting way to look at it, I think. Take me through what you're doing to explore each of those sections.
So we have Kishan doing the physical heart section.
So I've probably got the least emotionally relevant part of the research, which makes me quite sad. But nonetheless,
so you're emotional about it.
I'm emotional about it. I still find it tremendously fascinating. So I study abnormal heart rhythms, also known as arrhythmias. In particular, I study one of the most common abnormal heart rhythms called atrial fibrillation. Surprisingly, despite the fact it's the most common abnormal heart rhythm, the actual mechanisms of the disease aren't really well understood. And so kind of primary forms of treatment can have a success rate as low as 50%.
And what would be, so if you have atrial fibrillation or other types of arrhythmia, what does that do to you?
So luckily, if you have atrial fibrillation as opposed to ventricular fibrillation, in which case you would probably fall down and lose consciousness, you'd feel palpitations, you'd be short of breath. And this is because blood flow around the body is impaired. You're at a heightened risk of stroke because blood is pooling in your atria. And it also causes a lot of anxiety and a loss in quality of life, which is why it's still very important to treat and is heavily on the rise as we age as a population and therefore as a big thing that the NHS now has to deal with.
And just for anyone who wasn't quite clear, the atrium is that you have two atria in your hearts and two ventricles, four chambers. So the atria is like the smaller one, and the ventricle is the bigger one.
Yeah, so you've got two. Yeah, so you've got you've got the upper chambers, which are the atria, and they pump blood down to the ventricles, and the ventricles pump blood back into the body.
Yes. Okay. Great. And so I interrupted you there, but you were saying about your research.
Yeah. So, if you actually look at what goes on in the heart, you actually have these beautiful electrical waves which move from pacemaker cells all the way down the heart. And it's because you have these amazing kind of synchronized waves going across that your heart rate and heart rhythm is actually synchronized and smooth.
And that's making the top part of the heart contract first.
Exactly.
And the bottom part of the heart contract later. So it's that wave of contraction.
Exactly. And when these waves start moving in an abnormal ways, then the heart starts moving in abnormal ways and it can't pump blood efficiently. Even though abnormal, you'll find out later that there are some beautiful spiral waves which will be important, and so you can actually get rather beautiful patterns which are nonetheless deadly, which do form on the heart.
Beautiful yet deadly.
And so that's what I study. I try and mathematically model these electrical waves moving over the heart, because what's not understood is how is the actual structure of your heart. So your heart's actually made of lots of little cells in a brick wall like pattern which changes as we age, and how do those changes kind of promote these abnormal electrical waves? That's what I study.
And what have you found so far, or is it too early to say?
So it's quite speculative, as anything is from mathematical modelling, and so it kind of generates hypotheses for clinicians and biologists to go and check. And so the kind of conclusions we're coming to at the moment is, unsurprisingly, as we age, the changes that go in the heart promote this arrhythmia in a very characteristic way by causing these beautiful spiral waves to form on the surface of the heart. And these spiral waves can sometimes be tremendously unstable and break down to lots of little waves moving over the heart.
Almost like ripples.
Exactly. And so these are not conducive to having a nice, smooth rhythm.
And so I'm fascinated, how are you taking this research and incorporating it into your weekend? I know someone was saying earlier there's a dancer in one of your cabaret pieces, mm-hmm. and she actually has arrhythmia. But yeah, tell me more about that.
Okay, so specifically with Kishan's section, we are actually doing a short sketch, a comedy. It's kind of a farce. And in fact, Catherine is the actor within that one, called The Broken Heart.
Yes, I am. It's a beautiful little piece. It involves a man going to a doctor with alongside him his heart as a person.
As a character.
As a character. So it's just another way of showing people, you know, helping people understand their heart, because it is. How often have you felt that, you know, you just want your heart to heal, or you want to get over heartbreak? You know, so often we're at war with our own bodies and parts of them and emotions. So it's a brilliant, brilliant piece written by Sophia Mertens.
That's right. What if your heart had a mind of its own?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so often might feel like it
does. I think mine does.
Apparently there's research that does show that, in a sense, that we have memory cells in our heart, and not dissimilar to the stem cells in the brain when it comes to in the hippocampus.
So, memory cells in our heart.
Yes, and that's where that sort of inspiration came from as well, in terms of that particular sketch.
Do they think that that's behind why you sometimes might just have a kind of quite a physical reaction to someone?
Yeah, so funnily enough, in case you ever had a heart transplant. A lot of people report that they have these incredibly vivid dreams, and they're normally pretty nasty ones, kind of. And they come to the GP and they report what these dreams are, and the GP goes, well, the previous owner of your heart died in this way. So it's interesting what the heart does remember.
Oh my God, that's incredible. Wow. Time, I think, for our fourth song. We have got Peace of My Heart by Janis Joplin. Who chose this one?
This is just a lovely, this is me going back to sort of my slightly sort of, yeah, emotional, romantic self. Just a beautiful song. You find that there's a lot, especially in jazz, actually, there's a lot of tracks about the heart and love. So, yeah, so let's see where it goes.
Or multilingual might make you more creative. Although proving a direct link between these factors remains elusive, individuals who can speak more than one language are better at multitasking and in cognitive tests, both of which are key to creative thinking.
Creativity, I just think, is unlimitedly fascinating. Like, I'm always so interested in it, because you sort of think of it as like some people are creative and some people aren't.
Mm.
And is there any kind of science around what makes someone a creative person?
I personally don't subscribe to that. I don't think you're either born with it or you're not. I think it's like anything, like learning an instrument or a language, as we just said. I think you could actually like hone your creativity. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons I studied it, in terms of like trying to see what the processes are. It's not really about, well, it's sort of demystifying, but it doesn't make it any less mystical in the process of studying it. So my personal opinion is you can get more creative throughout your life.
Yeah, that is good news for everybody out there. And so what can you do to make yourself more creative?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of sort of psychological qualitative stuff that was done. I think I was mentioning earlier that when this a person called Wallace went and did a lot of case studies. It's a very long time ago, but he came up with four very broad stages of creativity. You might have heard of one of them, but the very first one is called the preparation period.
Ooh, no.
The preparation period, the incubation period, the light bulb moment.
Oh, yes, I have heard
that one.
That one,
yeah. And the verification period. This is very broad, and obviously, depending on what you do, there are more sort of finer sort of distinctions between them. But essentially, if you can, preparation is when you work on the problem. This is based on a problem-solving sort of paradigm. Preparation is when you work on the problem, you do the research, you kind of define the question. Incubation is when you leave it to the side and let your mind do its work.
I have heard people talk about this. Yeah, you kind of just let the subconscious work on it.
That's right.
And don't directly think about it.
So the idea is that your brain kind of has this sort of defocused attention. So when you're actually really working hard on something, that's basically all your attention. When it's defocused, it allows the brain to sort of metaphorically breathe, and you end up having more lateral connections between your thought processes. So something that could help this incubation period is going for a walk. Talking to your friends, cooking something nice. Doesn't mean you go off and attempt a mathematical PhD or anything that's incredibly taxing. So it's something that your brain can kind of, merrily tick away with, and then you come back to it, and you'll often find that sort of aha moment, that eureka light bulb moment, sort of that insight happens within your incubation period. You suddenly, for example, the very famous example is Kekule, who woke up remembering his dream, which is about a snake eating its own tail, and that's how the benzene ring came about. Oh, it's kind of interesting.
So the benzene ring is a chemical molecule that has a structure where the main carbons are all in a ring joined together.
That's right. And then the verification is kind of self-explanatory. It's when you go and you know, take this sort of creative idea to your peers. In our cases for performers, did the audience clap? and things like that. And if they didn't, you go back to the drawing board and you start the whole process again. So what you can do is, like, you know, is identify these different stages possibly and how you best, you know, reach them in terms of your particular sort of routines. And there's also different types of creativity. There's convergent creativity, there's divergent creativity.
And what do those mean?
So convergent creativity is very relevant to problem solving. It's basically when you only have one, or there's the best answer to something. So for example, solving a riddle is an example of
convergent.
Or thinking
of the answer to our question.
Exactly. That is convergent thinking. So you have many possibilities that you then narrow down into having, you know, just the highest probability of being correct. Divergent thing is much more fun because it's about having many different answers and there's no one single answer. And so if you play music, for example, and you're improvising, or, like, you know, if you're brainstorming in at your meeting, you know, and you're coming up with lots of ideas, you are actually divergently being creative.
Amazing. So, yeah. And so you, for your PhD, you actually studied creativity in music.
That's right.
How do you go about studying something that seems so elusive and intangible?
Well, in terms of elusive and intangible, I was also in the same group as Kishan here. We do complexity sciences. So we did I did neuroscience, and we used these statistical mechanical techniques in mathematics.
So just to emphasize, complex is not the same as complicated.
No.
So we're not saying that we do more complicated science than other people.
No,
other
not
people
at all.
Just do simple science.
So yeah, I guess complex system, it's something elusive. So what is a complex system, Kishan?
So, I mean, it's a very loosely defined term. But generally, it just means if you think about a system where you have lots of small interacting parts which come together, and the whole is more than the sum of its parts. And so people are actually taking that idea very, very seriously with a very kind of cold-hearted scientific lens.
I like the cold-hearted bit in there. Nice little link here. But yeah, so in this case, I was looking at the neuroscience of musical creativity, and I dealt with the brain as a complex system, and actually music is a complex system in itself as well. And so is creativity, as one of the highest cognitive things that you can do. You know, it involves decision-making, involves emotionality, involves, like, you know, having a very time-relevant accuracy. So I actually studied jazz and classical pianists, and I looked at their brainwaves when they were improvising, and also when they were interpreting a piece of music. So that is more in the classical idiom of things, and improvising is more in the jazz idiom of things, but I got them both to do both things. And also doing that, I measured their EEG, their electroencephalogram. So yeah.
And did you find a difference? Like, so jazz musicians, like you said, improvisation is part of jazz. Were they better at it? Were their brainwaves different?
There was definitely, like, you know, in terms of teaching, people have learned, you know, if you're a jazz musician who's gone to a jazz music college, you probably are much more, used to improvising. We definitely saw a different sort of brain activity in people who are more used to improvising. We also saw that, in my opinion, the type of music that you play, it also dictated the type of, you know, activity you saw in the brain. It was kind of inherent with classical music. It was much more sort of clustered and focused in specific areas. And with the jazz music, it was much more sort of like diffuse across a few different networks. It's kind of interesting.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, for all our listeners who want to stretch their convergent creative thinking.
Convergent and divergent, if you
tuned in late, our question that we asked you at the top of the show is, what do these four things all have in common? Slime, the tongue, bees, and the heart. So please tweet us what you think that is.
Can you tweet us as well with the Jugular Arts Eye? I would love to know
At Jugular Arts Eye as well. At Jugular Arts Eye, at Soho Radio.
And citizen science in action.
Yes. So let's play our fifth song. It's Alone. And this is by Heart. Who chose this one?
Again, I laugh because of Elliot chose this one. He goes, you know this song. Do I? No, I don't know this song. Yeah. Wait until the chorus hits. So yeah, hope you guys recognize it.
To the moon. How do I get?
you might be more creative when you're tired, as your brain is not as good at filtering out distractions. It's also a lot less efficient at remembering connections between ideas or concepts, which is good when it comes to creative work, which requires us to make new connections.
Exactly. That was your incubation phase in our fact. Brilliant.
Absolutely. And can I say it links in really neatly to something else we're showing?
Yeah, absolutely.
The Art Science Weekender. So we are doing a special preview of our full-length play called An Inevitable Stitch in Time.
Which, yes, tell me about this. You said it was about our modern relationship to time, and I find time fascinating.
Yeah, so originally the play was called The Rhythms of Time, and we decided to call it this. The protagonist essentially tries to engage creatively with different scientific theories of time in order to apply it to his own life and extend the time he's got left.
What would be different, like different theories of time? Tell me about that, because I think we all just have this concept of time as we know it in the 21st century.
Yeah,
linear and...
Well, actually, so there's biological ways of looking at it and physics-based ways of looking at it, which is what you just mentioned. So in this particular case, the protagonist suffers from a prion disease called fatal familial insomnia. So in this case, he's trying to sleep, and we just talked about tiredness and creativity, and essentially the prognosis is it goes more and more into hallucinations. But one of the things that he looks at is how to regulate his circadian rhythms. So from a biological point of view, we look at time in that way. And then we also do look at things like, what if you were a photon? You would never actually experience time if you're traveling at the speed of light.
Mm.
And so he tries to engage with these sort of like physics-based questions, and then also rather more philosophical ones, such as, you know, time isn't linear necessarily. What if past, present, and future all coexisted at the same time? Can he accept that? So, wow. Yeah.
And the idea that time, I think, is relative as well, depending on your experiences. I remember hearing a story about, you know, when people talk about near-death experiences and they talk about their life flashing time before their eyes and time slowing down. And
there's some
scientific research into why that happens. And they think it's to do with your memory.
That's right. We incorporated that as Dr. David Eagleman who did this. Yeah, so our protagonist tries to go on a bungee jump. To see if we can get a few more milliseconds. And it is something to do with our memory in terms of how if you have something that's new that's coming up or something that's a fear situation, you essentially put more attention to whatever's happening to you. Mm. So it feels like you're packing in a lot more things in the same 5 minutes.
Because actually our brain is filtering out so much of the information we get all of the time. But in this near-death situation, I guess it's if we survive, all this information will be useful as to how we survived. Yeah. So we're going to remember it all.
I mean, it's a beautiful play, and I think it looks at ways of expressing all these quite complex ideas.
Mm.
And that's something we try to do with the whole cabaret, you know, take different creative ways of telling these stories and
relate it to your everyday life, basically. So despite the fact that it's about prion disease, it's also about, you know, how any person can relate to time in their life, to sleep, to well-being. And also I mentioned about the fact that it has these underlying mechanisms very similar to Alzheimer's and dementia. You were talking also about the science cabaret.
Well, yeah, I was saying it's not a, you know, people think it's a new idea to combine arts and science, but not at all. It's a very, very old tradition. In the early 19th century, there was a very famous chemist called Humphrey Davy. In fact, he was apparently the first sort of, everyone fancied him, first a good looking women, because of him, women were allowed to go to many lectures, mainly because they fancied him, but they learned all the science. His best friend was, well, he was very good friends with Coleridge, the poet. They had what they called poetical science, a way of trying to, Humphrey was involved in looking up chemical elements and discovering them, and Coleridge would try and find beautiful ways of describing them, explaining them, find metaphors. You know, science is metaphors, things like a black hole, that's a metaphor really, to try and explain something, explain our world around us.
And also at the turn of the century, they used to have these enlightenment cafes, which involved a lot of different people coming together and having a chinwag, you know, whether they're a scientist or an artist or a poet or, you know.
Yeah, because I think back in the day, to do science, you kind of, it was a gentleman's thing. You didn't have a normal job, you lived off whatever inheritance you had.
Yeah. Not
you
so anymore.
All your time thinking. And that's kind of how modern, well, I'm not saying artists live off their inheritance or anything, but to be an artist is seen as much more of a sort of thinking career than a scientist in stereotypical ways.
I do think, I mean, the main thing that actually links the artist and the scientist is this indelible curiosity, and maybe, you know, the tools that they use are different, but it can be quite a solitary pursuit in some ways.
Yeah.
I guess, and what we try and do is make it more social as well. Apart from like the art science things that we do, which we're showcasing this weekend, we also do these monthly cross-disciplinary interdisciplinary salons called Dialogue. We do have a theme. The next one is on gender in August.
Is it a social construct?
Yeah, male or female. And then we involve, you know, a scientist, an artist, a tech wizard, a policymaker, anybody who's interested and linked with that particular theme. But coming back to the social aspect of things, we had the social heart as one of our sections, in Rhythms of the Heart, in the cabaret that's happening tonight. And what you guys did in terms of the experiment was an example of the social heart in terms of how do we get connected with each other in terms of our heart rhythms. And Kaz's going to talk a little bit about the emotional heart.
Do we want to quickly hear if we've got any tweets in? Producer Yaz?
Well, although I'm sure our heart rate that our singing have definitely affected people's heart rates, we haven't had anything in approaching the statistical significance we were looking for, unfortunately. But anecdotally, I'm sure we can all say singing in the shower, that's nice and relaxing and calming. You go to a concert and you're singing along and you feel very connected to the people around you. I think there's definitely, when you think about it, there's something big there with the heart rate and singing and the brain and creativity.
It's particularly like we've all been in a club or at a gig or something like that. And, you know, Glastonbury's coming up, and you know what it's like when you've gone through all of those social experiences with people, like talking about a festival, setting up your tent together, getting there together, standing in the queue together, and you're really building this social cohesion. So then when you get to the place where you're standing in the crowd full of people who also love the music that you love too, and you're moving together and singing together and your hearts are joining up together, there's an idea that empathy, or the way that we relate to each other on in an emotional level, is partly driven by what's going on in our body. So we can read what other people's bodies are doing without even being aware of it. So you're standing there moving together, physically active together, but also you're reading each other's bodies, and your bodies are talking, your minds are talking, and it's a beautiful experience. And maybe that's why we love going to music and experiencing social things like
that together. Shared experiences. Yeah. That's why cinemas are still popular. Everyone has a TV at home, but you want to go and watch that film and laugh and cry with others, even if you don't know who they are. We are running out of time, so we would like to be revealing the answer to our brain teaser. Now, I mean, I have no idea what it is. Have we had anyone tweeting in their answers?
Well, it was a very good brain teaser, a super tough one. No one came even close. We had a few suggestions. They've all got the letter E in them. I wouldn't want to touch any of them. But sadly, nothing. It's quite a tough one. So can you tell us the answer?
So the answer is that they all sustain spiral waves. And that's because, despite the fact that they're all made up of very different things, the kind of little rules which they use to interact with each other, Mexican wave-like rules, is all actually very similar. And so the macroscopic behaviours are all very similar.
So slime, how does slime have spiral waves?
So it's a very particular kind of slime, actually. I think the nickname of it's called Dicty. basically, a portion of the slime will emit a chemical signal to neighbouring parts of slime, telling them whether or not there's food or something stressful there. And then the neighbours then tell their neighbours via a chemical signal. So you have a Mexican wave of chemical signal. In the heart, you have a Mexican wave of electrical signals. In bees, you have a literal Mexican wave of showing their thorax to scare away predators. Was there one more?
The tongue.
Yeah, so there's an inflammatory process that can happen in the tongue. So inflamed regions of the tongue can inflame neighbouring regions of the tongue. So you have a Mexican wave of inflammation.
Wow.
And from those simple rules, you get very pretty complex patterns.
Yes, that's amazing. We have run out of time. I could talk to you guys all day. But if you want to hear more, get yourself down to the Ugly Duckling in Bermondsey. At 2 o'clock, we have the cabaret. Is that right?
No, at 2 o'clock, we have the play, An Inevitable Stitch in Time. And at 5:00, we have a free workshop all about the rhythms of the heart, if you want to actually experience what we're talking about in terms of interoception. And then at 7:30, we have Rhythms of the Heart, which is the science cabaret. The venue is Ugly Duck.
We'll be tweeting all this information as well. Yeah. And it's on today and tomorrow. That's all from us this week. We are playing out with your final song, Listen to the Heart by Roxette. Thank you so much.
Listen to your heart. When he's calling for you, listen to your heart. There's nothing.